dear brothers and sisters, when I was in the United States, my experience was that the German scholars are very theoretical and sophisticated. If a German and an American professor are given to, the task of classifying the kangaroo, the basic approaches will be very different. The German may be expected to proceed in a very detailed explanation by producing a prolegomenon to an exhaustive study of the problem, whether it is biologically determinable, whether a kangaroo is a mammal or not. The American will simply and pragmatically ask, can the kangaroo carry passengers too? hardly any representative of literary world, and certainly no theologian, has in the last decades exerted such fascination on the educated world as a paleontologist and Jesuit Teilhard de Chardin. No one was and is as controversial. Natural scientists, or certainly a part of them, accuse him of putting into question by metaphysical speculations his science, which in itself has precise methods. And the cardinals in Rome accuse him of incorporating the Christian dogma into a natural scientific theory of evolution, of alienating it therewith and overstepping the boundaries of heresy. Even today, many of his writings are not released for publication. They rest in the tomb of Parisian archives. I should now first of all say something about his richly experienced life and show how much his thought is tied up with the drama of his personal existence. But because I have merely short time, I am constrained to come to the point immediately. I would like in this hour to think through with you his conception of the unity of the world and of a meaningful future, not without the readiness to listen carefully, but likewise also not without criticism. Teilhard once said that his spirit had always been dominated by an insuperable yearning for organic unity and coherence, that is, for inner connection of all appearances. He hoped to see the cosmic and the Christian in a large synthesis. He says, quote, most immediately I am confronted with these two, the cosmic and the Christian, in the form of two apparently independent axes. The one lies within the sphere of knowledge, and the other in the sphere of faith. I am not capable, or at least I was not capable, of bringing these two together. Religion and natural science often tended to fall apart and appeared figuratively to tear me apart. Only after a long time and after many attempts, he says, have I come to that point where I was able to see through and beyond the human conversions, similarity, and finally even their basic identity. There are then two spirits in my heart which fight with one another and threaten to tear him apart. The spirit of the exact sciences and the spirit of the Christian faith. His yearning to find a unified world formula which satisfies this agonizing contradiction and brings into harmony the hostile opponents, this yearning is thus born out of pain. This fact gives to this thought the quality of passion and of existential engagement. It also gives to this thought its dramatic accent. Teilhard's passion for unity of thought and being realizes itself in such a fashion that it discovers a conception which encompasses all forms of life and correlates them in a meaningful order to one another. This conception is evolution. This magic word is that category in which the world formula is contained and in which all contradictions are reconciled. This evolution or development includes even this present world and the world to come. The present world is included in the development insofar as here we are concerned with biological phenomena which develop in interconnected processes or also in jumps in the form of mutations. But also the world beyond has part in this development. For in the natural processes, divine powers are at work. This process of nature has, so to say, a spiritual and internal aspect which programs the natural process, directing it towards its goal. No wonder that therefore these spiritual motivations cannot remain hidden, and that the material within which they are active become increasingly permeated with spirit and therefore transparent. This process of permeation with spirit and achieves its highest point at that time when matter becomes conscious of itself. At one stage of development, that is, when the human brain forms itself and the so-called noosphere arises, at which stage thought and consciousness begins. In this way, although thought is included in that development, in it that is revealed which was incorporated into the world processes from the very beginning. Teilhard says, quote, "In order to give to thought its place in the world, I had to internalize matter, so that it produces out of itself spiritual possibilities and self-consciousness. I had to invent an energy of spirit, and finally to let all things return to someone as an original beginning." Exactly that conception of evolution, which had in Darwin's theory of descendancy brought about a profound alienation between biology and theology, exactly that conception of evolution which appears to contradict the biblical theory of creation by means of a verifiable and long evolution, and which had caused the Christian faith to become an extraterrestrial stranger in the midst of the landscape of modern science, exactly this conception of evolution is now to bring both together again in order to reconcile them. But the encompassing synthesis which Teilhard conceives or of which he dreams are significant in even broader spheres. Not only faith and knowledge, theology and biology are encompassed by them, but rather all the contradiction of thought and action is overcome with them. Fortea appeals to man to complete the cosmos, which is creation, to be not merely a fellow traveler and passenger of this development, but rather to will it out of himself and to speed up its momentum. This is his opinion. If he penetrates spiritually the processes of the world, we do this not for the sake of knowledge only. Rather, we want to know in order to be able to change and fashion the world on the basis of this knowledge. With this theme, Teilhard builds a bridge to certain ideas of Karl Marx, and he is concerned also in this direction to overcome a separation. For also in Teilhard we find what it is so characteristic for Marxism. I mean the combination of the hope to interpret the world, that is, by understanding its laws, to penetrate into its historical processes, together with the other hope to change the world on the basis of this insight, to understand it and simultaneously to interfere with it. It is almost as if a new, out of the spheres of biology and theology constituted Hegel is at work here, who is capable once more to bring together in a monumental synthesis that which is desperately falling apart. There is no thing between heaven and earth which does not have room in Teilhard's word formula. Indeed, heaven and earth are themselves encompassed by this formula. But not only the synthesis is so fascinating, something else has to be observed. The spirit of affirmation which arises out of it. You all know the thesis of a certain Christian cultural pessimism, for example, atomic technology and biological manipulation are destructive. Or the question, what shall come when man interferes with the human genetic makeup and when he creates, according to his blasphemous plans, the ghostly forms of a new homunculus? To know more than one can responsibly deal with leads to mischief, and so on. Over against such questions, Teilhard confronts us with an enthusiastic affirmation of technical progress. He understands the development of atomic physics, the first results of virus research, and the more and more precise knowledge of genetics as a significant signals of a coming mastery of all processes of life. And Teilhard himself can say, quote, will the discovery of the genes not soon open up to us the control of the mechanism of organic heredity? Will the coming synthetic production of proteins not enable us to call forth the development which the earth would never have produced out of itself, namely a new wave of organisms, the newly created neo-vitality, a new world of life created by man? He calls these processes the human revitalization of evolution, an act in which man assumes the initiative for the completion of creation instead of simply letting creation proceed on its own and surrendering it finally to its own helpless and idle momentum. We could express this theologically. At a certain stage of evolution, namely at that place where the material becomes conscious of itself in the human brain, man becomes co-creator, the co-operator of God, so to say, the junior partner of the divine world form, in which role man drives with new energy the tired creation into a new and promising future which is programmed by himself. In this activity manifests itself his maturity, his capacity of being a partner of God, to be the image of God. I do not know whether you feel as I do. I do. One shivers over the uncertainty of the question whether we are confronted here with a blasphemous arrogation of a Prometheus or with a humble acceptance of grace which grants to man his divine image. Thea can say in a most pointed formulation, the secret dream of human research yearns to master the energies of the atoms and the molecules in order therewith to gain domination of the basic energy of which all other energies are merely servants. Should that point come, we would all take hold of the rudder by placing our hand on the real moving force behind evolution. What we all sense to be hybris, Thea himself believes to be piety. For, again a quote, to the most courageous, to those who admit that their hopes go so far, I say, that they are the most human among men. Between research and adoration, there is less of difference than one commonly conceives. His technological enthusiasm, therefore, is not Promethean, but rather leads to adoration. When he stood 1952, breathless before the gigantic cyclotron of the University of California at Berkeley, he summed up his thoughts later in this way, quote, what we generally call research became filled, tinged, and vital with new powers such as faith and adoration. These emotions were heretofore considered to be foreign to science. But for me, they became the determinate impulse to understand them as arising out of one common root. In view of such a symbol of technocracy, which theologian and had ever resorted to such words? Words that could be described as a hymnic technological physical adoration. Here, Franciscus of Assisi's hymn to the sun is applied to the technological world. In Teilhard, no one can possibly say that technology is separated as a demonic and disobedient sphere out of the kingdom of God and reduced to an antibody in creation. He does not understand it as a possible power of the homo faber, which attempting to be like God rebels against him. Oh no, in technology, the spiritual background of creation becomes visible. Here, that point is reached at which God calls men to be responsible together with God for the progress of creation. How does now that development look, which is active in Teilhard's thought as a unifying world formula? I shall indicate at first only the stages of this development. The first stage consists in the anorganic nature before the rise of life, which is followed with the second stage, the vitalization. It is characterized by the self-reproduction of organisms, that is, in a process which did not as yet exist in gases, in liquids, in the crust of the earth, including the crystals, and which is therefore the opposite of the fate of the purely material world, which will die in the increasingly cooling earth. The third stage, the evolution of the species, the basic material of life, differentiates more and more and develops in a multiplicity of various forms. Schematized, this process of the species can be represented with a manifold branching out of the tree of life. Out of one of the main branches develops the branch of the mammals, and out of this one, the promising group of the primates, the animals of domination, to which also belongs man. Fourth stage, cerebration, development of brain. By means of this endowment of living beings with brain, that is, with potentials to think, the universe becomes conscious of itself. One could also say this: evolution brought about a stage on which the development is thought, and at which it can then also be promoted consciously. Man himself is, as Teilhard says, nothing else than evolution which has become conscious of itself. That is his anthropology. Also, man himself is nothing else than evolution which has become conscious of itself. In this manner, the biosphere as a world of organic life develops further into the noosphere, which is a sphere of knowledge and conscience. Fifth and final stage, Teilhard understands as a final point of the whole development the so-called point omega, at which culminates the whole development, and at which the whole development achieves simultaneously thought of a mystical unification with God. At the point omega, quote, everything comes together, finds its explanation, feels at home, owns itself. What has been up to this point only a background power which gave spirit to matter and which programmed it is now all in all. After having explained to ourselves the form of this development, we have now to ask the question, how is this development initiated? What its creative motivation which sets it in motion? In describing the origination and development of new species, Teilhard uses mostly the common concepts of biology. He knows here all those jumps which are understood to be the accidents called mutations, and which today are common elements of the accepted theories of evolution. But the manner in which Teilhard interprets these mutations is characteristic for his thought. For it is his opinion that if one understands mutations only as a result of an accident, they cannot explain the stages of the various processes of life. There would have to be at work a guiding component which determines the so-called orthogenesis. With this concept, Teilhard understands the directed unraveling of evolution. He thus conceives a teleological drift in the development, which is driving towards an end purpose. Not only causes are active in it, but rather also purposes, goal-directed programming. Already in its original stage, matter has, Teilhard can see, a dull and rudimentary psyche. For this reason, nothing is in the world could appear one day as a final purpose which was not present, however darkly, at the very beginning. Consequently, one cannot even think a goal-directed development of life processes or the genesis if one does not take into account the spiritual component or this soul of the process, namely the component which was active in matter from the very beginning. In this matter also, mutations become meaningful. For the accident of the jumps of mutations provides a free sphere of development for this spiritual principle. This sphere of development makes it possible for this spiritual principle to become active as an inherent preference. With this formula, Teilhard describes a power which is capable to choose one among many possibilities, which can prefer the one possibility and reject the other. Such free activity is of course possible only if things do not develop according to the unalterable law of cause and effect, when things are not simply determined, but rather when there are open and undetermined spheres. And precisely such zones of freedom are provided by the accidents of mutations. This secret power of choice is most apparent in the promising group of the primates. For in this group we are confronted with beings which are selected in their biological processes and which finally are determined in their ascent to become man. Teilhard characteristically speaks here of the arrow of the humanum, which flies goal-directed. In reality, this arrow is a racket with several stages, the various parts of which make it possible to advance to definite stages of development. With all of the proceeding, I have indicated only a few central points of that which Teilhard says about evolution, and much that is important, unfortunately, has to be passed by. But here we come to the point where Teilhard's understanding of development becomes important for us theologically. For if the impulses of the divine spirits is active in matter from the very beginning, and if it gives to matter its soul and guides its development with a goal-directed certainty, then there is surely for a paleontologist who is at the same time Jesuit an association to Jesus Christ. That which Teilhard had called the spiritual energy which is active in the world is after all precisely that point at which creator and creature touch each other and where they recognize each other and coincide. Since Christ is now the Word of God having become flesh, and since therefore his presence is in the world, one can assume that Teilhard recognizes in this matter-energizing power, in this power of preference, this Christian element. We can assume that he therein understands an actualizing of the incarnation, and thus an entry of Christ into the world. The incarnation understood thus is now, to be sure, still hidden, even if no longer altogether hidden. Totally unrecognizable, it cannot be, for the simple reason that the soul of the world, discovered by Teilhard, this goal-directed and guiding power of the spirit, would have to convince even unbelievers. This goal-directed and guiding power of the spirit would have to convince even unbelievers. Teilhard implies that whoever observes reality unprejudiced and with an open mind can do no other than to recognize the traces of this spirit which is engrafted into the world. These traces therefore turn evolution almost into a proof of God, which displaces the blind faith with an obvious knowledge. Nevertheless, only at the end of the world process will that be elevated to perfect clarity which can now only be suspected in traces and in signs. Only at the point Omega will Christ be completely fulfilled. We may be permitted to express it in this way. Only at that time will the incarnation of Christ in the world will have become identification of Christ with the world. At that time, his cosmic character is fulfilled. Quote, "The whole Christ becomes complete and is attainable only at the end of universal evolution." But which relation to Christ do I have now, at in this moment of evolution, at which evolution is still in progress? This is, after all, our moment. This is my and your moment. Does he still confront me in this concealment on the cross, where God is so disfigured, so as to be unrecognizable? Is God here really still hidden in his utmost concealment, so that I can say, nevertheless, in spite of your concealment, I will stay with you? I fear that Teilhard no longer has any room for this faith, which on the basis of its nevertheless provides blind trust out of the very depths. My relation to Christ takes place in Teilhard's thought no longer in the manner that I trust him contrary to that which is visible with the eyes, but rather in my making out his traces in the universe in fact, in my entering into the universe. For whoever enters into the world, whoever becomes altogether worldly, necessarily comes close to that spiritual Christian principle which is active as a moving force in the world process. I recognize, Teilhard says, that I can be saved in following the incarnated God only when I enter the universe wholly. In this manner, Christ turns from a figure which calls forth my belief into a cosmic figure of salvation, into the Lord of all, who becomes the spiritual center of universal evolution. No doubt, certain aspects of the New Testament, for example in Colossians, can be understood in this framework in a totally new light. At the same time, however, one is frightened by this speculation in which Christ becomes a verb principle, which one can recognize without faith, and the evidence of which can be made out also apart from discipleship of Christ. Is God's future really of such nature that one can make it out in microscopes and with the telescopes? And is that which one reads in the Gospels at best the affirmation of what I have already discovered in my world analysis apart from the Gospel? One fears the possibility that here everything might rest on deceit, and that which in logics is called petitio principii, or begging the question. Is it not possible that Teilhard projects that which his church has taught him about God into his worldview in order to rediscover it then as an apparent invention in the world? Almost like an magician takes that rabbit out of his hat which he has placed there before. Certainly our suspicion of a trick is in such an honorable figure like Teilhard no conscious manipulation. Nevertheless, we cannot get around posing this critical question. May we accept then in Teilhard that which is so fascinating in his thought? May we believe that monumental unity in which is joined together in a translucent synthesis, or even into an identity, God and world, spirit and matter, the Christic and the cosmic, this world and the world beyond? And once more the magic of this vision touches us when we hear this confession, quote, "The great event in my life was a gradual identification of two suns on the heaven of my soul. The one of these stars was a cosmic pinnacle to which evolution pointed when its spiritual drives became more and more apparent, and the other was formed by the resurrected Jesus of the Christian faith. These two suns are," this is a pathos of this thought, "identical. And it is deceit and self-destruction when we see both science and faith in the relation of separation or even of contradiction. Here, Teilhard has indeed posed to Christianity the decisive question. We have to ask for the relation of faith and knowledge, of faith and thought. If we do not ask thus, we will fall into a disastrous split within our consciousness. We are then in the one part of our consciousness pious, and in the other we are enlightened. With this, we would betray the faith apart from the fact that this world leads to a caricature of man, and that this break of consciousness would become the source of neurosis and even worse. For God demands of us more than merely the pious sector of our ego, and more than our religious province. For God is not provincial, and he is not satisfied with installment payments. He demands us totally. Therefore, he demands that we praise him all with our reason. He does not demand of us to turn off the activity of our brain, but rather when we think him, and that is a present, that is present in everything which we think, that the physicist can bring him together with his physics, and the historian with his history, and that they respect him as their lord. Whatever may be said about Teilhard, his encompassing vision is in any case an impressive appeal to reflect on the relation of faith and knowledge and about the worldhood of God. Even if he himself may solve this question in a manner which we cannot accept, the questionableness of his synthesis is nevertheless a creative appeal to all those who have received the call to live as mature Christians in the world. And that implies that we have to explain how it is possible to believe as thinking and as acting persons, and how we will obtain out of our faith a totally new relation to the world. May I be permitted to mention one last point of view, which accounts for the reason why Teilhard touches particularly young people. Almost in Europe, I don't know how it is in America. Young people is very engaged by Teilhard. He has no application for the evil in man, or formulated as a Christian, he has in his thought no place for the event of the fall. It may appear to you as strange when I say that precisely this deficiency in Teilhard is instrumental in making him acceptable, especially to the restless and sometimes revolutionary youth. I have briefly to give reasons for this, but first I must explain why evil is an unsolved problem in Teilhard. Whether it be in Origen, or Hegel, or Teilhard, one can make the same observation in all representatives of a monistic worldview, that is, in a worldview which understands all reality to emerge out of one single original reality, into which it will also return. Because everything originates out of the same ground, therefore also good and bad cannot be genuine and irreconcilable opponents. They are rather related with one another because they are, after all, rooted in the common original unity. And this way, the evil is in Hegel merely a dialectical transition. It is a productive contradiction to the good. And the good needs this contradiction in order to come into its own. Also in Goethe, this thought emerges when he says about Mephistopheles as a personified evil. He is a part of that power which always hopes to do evil and always creates the good. The polarity of good and evil is therefore a fruitful and creative principle. We spoke yesterday evening about this problem. For that reason, evil is also good in a final sense. It requires our freedom, therefore trains us in the use of freedom. Evil, therefore, has a positive meaning. The evil is altogether a creative power which is needed by life. For that reason, it is in no sense destructive. Teilhard has no sensitivity for that evil and that demonic element in human hybris which began in the fall and which indicates a false use of human freedom which is capable of spoiling creation and which in fact can, at a certain level of technological power, lead to self-destruction. Teilhard was always somewhat embarrassed when he was asked in view of these questions. I fear that precisely this problematical aspect is attractive to the younger generation. Also in the fashionable utopias and in the dreams of a unified and unrepressive world, in those visions, therefore, which are again and again the motor behind revolutionary passions, we become aware of the fact that the world's paycheck is made up without the host, namely without that man whose evil always sabotages those ideal world constructs. For it is a gigantic error to have the opinion that the realization of perfect societal structures, that is, non-repressive and just structures, will cause crime, jealousy, hatred, and other inferior drives to disappear in man. For him, whose vision is trained by the biblical view of things, precisely the opposite is true. The utopian order of the world falls down in the fact that man himself is not in order and that he therefore remains the saboteur of God's creation. For that reason, I am of the opinion that we should not think exclusively of the perfection of the world order, whether in the revolutionary sense that one hopes to realize this order with the passion of the Promethean actor, or whether one dreams in Teilhard's sense of the point omega at which, in spite of or through all errors and mistakes, the happy end of history will be realized with evolutionary certainty. For the Christian, it will have to remain the central and real question to remain aware of the crisis in the human heart and to present those powers of renovation of which the Gospels are full. Only if we keep this darkness of man's heart in mind, while at the same time thinking of the promise that this darkness shall be enlightened and that to us the power of grace is promised, only then, in my opinion, will one be secure against utopian dreams? And will one find the right criteria with which realistically and soberly to work in the world in order to make it somewhat more just and to bring it a little closer to God's plan of creation? The future of God is not the dream of a perfect world. No, this future will always remain the situation of the father who waits for the return of his lost son. And that the son will find back from distant lands and will be welcomed is no automatic process, but is rather the miracle of grace over against which the calculations of our thinking is impotent. With this I have come to the end and am thankful for your patience with which you have followed this strenuous path through the fascinating but also labyrinthian world of this sort. I shall close with a confession that I don't have an altogether good conscience. Some of you will as yet perhaps not have encountered personally Teilhard's work, and for those of you it might have been better simply to take cognizance of his monumental view of things and to be impressed by it rather than to be confronted with the famous yes, but. And yet it is part of Teilhard's greatness that one cannot enjoy him from an aesthetical distance, but that he rather engages one. So he immediately forced one to take a position. The dignity of this great man demands that we shall not be enamored by him, but that we rather wrestle with him.